Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, my fellow Westorians. It's Aziz here with a special bonus episode. We could do a whole episode on all the things that has made Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire a worldwide hit. But one of those things we would focus on if we did such an episode would be that it seems to offer something for everyone. Some love the fantasy elements, some love the real-world allegories and parallels, some love the interpersonal conflicts and witnessing the various characters' tragedies and triumphs, some are drawn to the acting, cinematography, or writing, some love all of the above, or most of the above. One of the more conspicuous elements people love about Game of Thrones I didn't mention is war, battles, strategy, tactics, logistics, morale, weaponry, terrain, weather. And that's not nearly all. There's a lot to dig into with just this one subtopic. And that's exactly the sort of thing we love to do here at the History of Westeros podcast. Detailed analysis from people who have done their homework. But I'm understating this. I never had to write a book for a homework assignment in school, so homework is putting this mildly. With us today are two esteemed writers that have done just that. Written a book called Winning Westeros, How Game of Thrones Explains Modern Military Conflict. I gotta say, it's really good. I haven't read the whole thing yet. It's a great book that deserves a lot of attention, a lot of focus. But what I've read so far, which is mostly your guys' chapters, has been really excellent. So without any further ado, let me introduce you guys. First off, author, award-winning strategist, Matt Cavanaugh. Welcome.
Hey. Yeah, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you.
Right on. And you are the co-founder of the Modern War Institute, is that right?
I am. It's a small think tank in upstate New York, north of the city, about an hour, at West Point, where I also went to college myself at the least fun educational higher learning institute in America, and then I was teaching there from 2012 to 2015 when the Modern War Institute came together. So yeah, it's 4 years old at this point now.
Right on. That's very cool. I actually have a slight connection to that. My grandfather was also a West Point grad. And so I've heard a few stories, but
he probably had just as much fun as I did.
Yes,
it hasn't changed much in that regard.
Yeah, I think he has said some similar things. It's true. And our other guest, welcome, Max Brooks.
Thank you. Good to be here. I think we should, for the record, just state our respective official titles.
Yes, we should.
You know, Matt Cavanaugh. He has two titles. He is Lieutenant Colonel Cavanaugh, active duty, United States Army. He is also Dr. Cavanaugh, who just got his PhD.
See, I saw the Lieutenant Colonel part, but I didn't see the doctor part, so thank you for adding that. It's important to have the title straight around here. That's very true.
Oh, very much so. Now, and my title is just some guy who writes about zombies and stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's why we love him.
Yeah. Well, let me get some obligatory gushing out of the way. I was introduced to World War Z through my mother, who was listening to the audiobook on a long, long road trip, and I got sucked in. I really liked it. And ever since, I've been adamant that that is the way a Song of Ice and Fire audiobook should be done. I'm really, I love Roy Dotrice, who did the Song of Ice and Fire audiobooks, but it's just too much to ask one guy to do hundreds of voices. So having multiple actors do it, it was great. I really loved that. So it's not what we're here to talk about, but I had to say that.
No problem.
Right on. Well, a concept that you guys dig into very deep is that while Game of Thrones is relatively new on the world stage as far as history goes, using popular stories as cultural touchstones is as old as human history itself. And that concept is introduced immediately in Winning Westeros. I took the liberty of grabbing a quote from the foreword to kind of get people excited, because this is something that I think is right along the lines of things that we discuss fairly often in the fandom. So bear with me real quick, I'll read this quote. The foreword was written by retired Admiral James Stavridis, and I just have to quote part of it here, it's so good. What if questions are the root of strategic thinking? Because the outcomes are not a matter of historical record. I have always found these questions easier to ask when reading works of fiction. Tracing the imaginary career of Captain Jack Aubrey through O'Brien's novels, I constantly asked myself what I would do in the situations he faced. Time and again, I found that this mental exercise paid off when I encountered similar situations in real life. The Aegis destroyers I sailed in might have been much more high-tech than the wooden men of war of Captain Aubrey's day, but the challenges of discipline, the tension of preparing for battle, and the pressures of command are enduring elements of naval life. This idea, of course, applies equally well to film and television. There's much leadership to be gleaned in superb films like The Caine Mutiny Court Martial or the long-format television such as The Winds of War. In today's world of series television, there is no more global strategic plot line than that of Game of Thrones. I encourage all readers to apply the what-if technique to these chapters while reading, and not only to the fictional circumstances they describe, but also to the author's conclusions. After all, one of the greatest benefits of reading fiction is the variety of interpretations it allows. We all know what happened at Trafalgar, but Westeros offers nearly unlimited opportunities to ask ourselves, what if? The lessons from the struggles to dominate this fictitious world echo quite clearly onto our own. So, first of all, that's a fantastic quote. It's a really well written, and it nails a lot of what we love about what Game of Thrones does in terms of inspiring discussions. But how did you guys, just before we talk about the material itself, how did you guys organize all these people? There's so many incredible authors who contributed. You have Admiral Stavridis, but also generals, policy advisors, counterinsurgency specialists, and also authors of sci-fi and fantasy. So it's a really amazing group you've assembled. How did you manage to pull that off?
We had them at gunpoint for a couple hours. You know, so really, I mean, it's a fantastic question. And for I played the ringleader to some extent, but it wasn't hard to get the bear to dance in the circus. Hmm. You know, basically, this is a group of people that, like a lot of academic writers, they write about subjects for a relatively narrow and small audience. One of our writers, for example, Colonel Liam Collins, is the director of the Modern War Institute. His PhD dissertation was on counterinsurgency, but it's not exactly something that you would want to read. And, you know, I've heard Max refer to it as sort of printed Ambien, that would just probably knock an elephant over. But, when we get an opportunity to share some of these ideas in a different way for a wider audience, we jump that chance. And, no one's making gobs of money on this project, but every single writer that contributed was inspired and excited to contribute because it was an opportunity to take counterinsurgency or air power or even bigger ideas related to war and human conflict and put them in a context that people are already interested to learn and talk about. And so, I mean, really, like, it wasn't hard to get, you know, almost 3 dozen writers to contribute based on hundreds of years of strategic experience, literally hundreds of years of strategic experience. So,
well, yeah, when you put it that way, it makes a lot of sense.
I should say that we should make sure that your listeners know this is a sequel to our first strategy book. And the first book was Strategy Strikes Back, and it was teaching strategy through Star Wars, and this all came about because of Matt. Because Matt, why don't you tell them where just the idea of doing a book like this came from?
Oh yeah, we'd love to hear that.
Yeah, so I mentioned I taught at West Point from 2012 to 2015, and you know I've got young children. I am approaching the middle part of my life, and you know it's hard sometimes to have a conversation about military strategy with college kids, with cadets. And so there's a cultural, you know, an age gap there. And then from that assignment at West Point, I took an assignment in Korea where I was working with Korean army officers every day. Okay. And there's an even bigger cultural gap there, right?
Yeah.
And the, you know, one of the wars we all around the world know something about is Star Wars. It crosses languages, cultures, generations. And what I learned pretty quickly is that it really speeds up the conversation if you start with a common frame of reference or a common terrain, so to speak. And it's not just for cadets or colonels or Koreans. It's for civilians too. Right now, Game of Thrones is owning the pop culture conversation. And we can use that popularity. We can leverage that popularity to have conversations with people, you know, people with short haircuts like myself, with people with slightly longer haircuts. And it can be mutually beneficial and interesting and engaging. So we started with Star Wars, and we basically took it up to Mach 2 with winning Westeros. About half of our writers from the Star Wars book came over to work on winning Westeros with us. And it's been, I mean, it's been just as fun a project to continue in Westeros.
That's excellent. I think a lot of our listeners would love to read the Star Wars one as well, because frankly, there's a lot of crossover in Star Wars fandom and Game of Thrones fandom. Not surprising in general, and of course, because they're just so popular. That's a great point. You know, the more popular something is, the more common ground everyone has, and that by itself is extremely powerful. Well, let's before one last question before we get into your chapters. I want to know, how did you guys come to find Game of Thrones in the first place? Matt, you go first.
You know, for me, my wife and I started watching probably about the time the third season was on the air, and we jumped in and then went to the, you know, to the start and then caught ourselves back up. So we weren't with the sort of initial viewing tranche. So we were behind the power curve, and I did pick up the first couple of books as we started going. The reason that I think that we were a little slow on the uptake is that, we're not prudes or anything, but like violent shows sometimes turn us back.
Yeah.
And so that was to be honest, that was a little bit of a deterrent. The other thing is like, with little girls running around the house, the idea of some of those early scenes from the show, my kids, you know, their eyeballs, their faces might have melted from, you know, like in Indiana Jones, like when they see the Ark of the Covenant. So we were slow, but what you realize pretty quickly, I think, with the show and with the books is that there's such a fantastic story there. And as we went along watching, I would see little moments either on screen or pop off the page that I had seen in history books, in textbooks, and in things that I do at work when it comes to military strategy. Dragons, to me, look like air power, but interestingly enough, Max sees them as the NKVD or a secret police. The Battle of the Bastards is Cannae from the Second Punic War. Corpses that you see stacked up, that's 1864 in Virginia in our Civil War. There are little moments that just jumped out at me, and it made me really feel like I was watching sort of a remix of history, like a very artful remix of history. And what really sealed it for me, at least, and what's made me a fan and kept me through the series is that the human dynamics in conflict, you can spot them from a mile away, and they've portrayed them so well. Yes, they're souped up. I mean, it's souped up. You know, George R. R. Martin said he went to Hadrian's Wall in England, stood on that, and that was kind of his initial moment of inspiration for the wall. So of course it's souped up, But it's a reflection of reality. And so that's really what grabbed me and my wife. We, you know, we'll be watching. We're tuned in the moment it starts, each one of these last.
Yeah, we're not a few hours away from episode two, huh?
That's
well, what about you, Max? How did you find Game of Thrones? Certainly, some people would assume it had something to do with the zombie connection, but surely there's a little more to it, if not a lot more.
It did, but not. It came. Yes, it was a zombie connection, but not in the way you would think. It came by George R. R. Martin himself.
How about that?
You know, many, many years ago, I was on a panel at a comic book convention, and we were talking to the audience about, you know, just storytelling in general. And they put me next to this, like, old Santa Claus looking dude in a Greek hat. And they were like, yes, yeah, most of you may not know this gentleman, George R. R. Martin. His books are about to be a wonderful new HBO series. And, you know, the people in the audience are yawning and leaving because there's like a, you know, there's a Naruto panel next door or something like that. And so nobody was paying much attention. Except for, I guess, the hardcore fans who'd actually read the books. And hearing George talk about characters and about you can't have infallible people make a good story. They have to make bad decisions or else you're not going to go anywhere. And so as a writer, I was entranced by the writer. And I thought, I want to see what came out of this guy's brain. So he hit me.
Right on. That's great. George is really quite something. I met him at a convention where he simply walked into a hotel room where there was a party, sat down on a chair, grabbed a beer, like he wasn't a famous person, you know? He just walked right in, and everybody's just kind of staring. And
well, he's an interesting guy because he was not an overnight sensation. He was breaking rocks for 90% of his career.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, he's an overnight sensation, and George the Man is an interesting study in fame, which we can get into much later. And then when I got into the show, the visceral response I had to the show is the exact same response I have now, which is what prompted me to write the book. Because it's all about the rightful heir, right? The rightful king. I mean, literally the last episode we just saw, when they were like, you've got to tell him the truth. Jon Snow, you're the rightful king. And my answer to that is, no, you're not. Because there is no rightful king. Nobody has the right to be king. No one person has the right, just because of accident of birth, to have life or death decisions over millions of people. That is just absolutely wrong. And so that's why I watched the show, and that's what my chapter is.
It sure is. Your chapter is called Micah's Parents Didn't Get a Vote, and you absolutely talk about things like power dynamics and taking democracy for granted, who stands up for the oppressed. I grabbed a quote here from you that I think is really sums it up, parts of it really well. In 2018, Game of Thrones was a fantasy. In 1776, it was everyday life. The framers of our Constitution saw what happens when a handful of drunken, incestuous, and in the case of King George III, mentally ill mob dons have direct control over millions of subjects. That is why we are citizens, not subjects. That is why our Constitution is our king. Really well said. So relevant to right now and other periods in history as well, of course. King George III, mentally ill, that's a direct parallel to the Mad King Ares, who was, you know, King George wasn't as cruel as, but that's the whole dialing up you talked about.
Oh, yeah, and you know, for democracy, and I saw that, I see this a lot, and I saw it in the election of 2016, where I talked to people who kept saying things like, I just want to shake things up, you know, I just want to shake it up, and being a student of history and also of the world, because that world of dark tyranny didn't go away. You know, the majority of the human race now lives in darkness and fear. They don't get to speak their minds. They don't get to be themselves. They don't get lawyers and judges and a free press. They all can risk having their Micah chopped up by the ruler's hounds and dumped on their doorstep. And so when I have people rail against the deep state or the system or the establishment, I say, you better get down on your knees and thank the souls of people who bled before you to give you the right to let your voice be counted.
Right on. Well said. And just on the case of Micah specifically, too, it's a common debate in the fandom what Sandor's duty, the morality of him being someone trapped in between, ordered to do this killing, whereas, as you say, who gave the king the right to do these things in the first place, to make these laws and to define what's right for everybody?
I don't think he's the enemy there. I don't think the King's Hound is as nearly as guilty as Ned Stark.
I agree. I would agree.
Because Ned Stark knows better. And that was actually the crux of the prosecution at the Nuremberg trials, where all those stupid, uneducated, hate-filled, shit-eating camp guards at Auschwitz were not nearly as guilty as the educated elite of Germany, who knew better and knew what could happen and agreed to it anyway. And so when Ned Stark is lying in bed and sort of whines and moans and sighs and goes, King takes what he wants. He takes what he wants because you let him. You know it's wrong, and you do it anyway. You let evil flourish. And so he's the guilty party in that.
And this is a great way to explain part of what's going on in this book, in Winning Westeros, is that there's so many authors and so many takes that you guys don't all agree with each other on everything, and that's a good thing because it allows people to see intelligent arguments from different people with different perspectives, and people may find themselves agreeing with two different arguments that may somewhat contradict each other just because there's parts of it that they can gel with or that mean something to them. So let's take this a little bit further as far as the series itself. We've gotten Tyrion and Dany and a few others have hinted at this, maybe not directly, but have suggested that maybe this isn't the right system of government. Maybe, like Dany's comment about breaking the wheel, and Tyrion's talk about how, you never know what you're going to get with monarchs and things like that. Do you guys think, this is a question for both of y'all, do you think that the Iron Throne will exist at the end of the series? And if you do think so, I'd love to hear your guess on who might sit it at the end. Let's go with Matt first.
Well, you know what? I got to pitch it to Max because he's got a really good theory about what should happen in the Iron Throne.
My dream ending is that, Daenerys and Jon, they win the war, and yay for the power couple, Jon Arryn. And they get up there, and the crowd cheers and says, "Thank you, but you've done your time. Your term of service is over. You have to step down. We need to hold elections, and we need to melt the Iron Throne down into Balbaugh."
Into Balbaugh. That's very specific. I like that. I've heard the concept of melting down the Iron Throne, but I haven't ever heard anyone discuss what they could turn that metal into. That's a great idea. And Matt, what about you?
So this one's a little bit different. This comes out of my epilogue, but it relates to why we did the book. You see very clearly what happens when a society, gets cut off from its military to some extent that protects them, and its academics. And you see that with the Night's Watch at the beginning of the series and in the books. They're neglected, they're small, they're sort of, no one cares to some extent, and they're a very small sliver of society. When they see the threat that's coming, they send ravens, they try to warn the rest of the Seven Kingdoms, and they're sort of laughed off. No one really listens. And you get the same thing when Samwell Tarly goes to the Citadel to become a maester. He tells them what he's seen with his own two eyes, and to some extent, the maesters, the academics of Westeros, choose to sort of stay separated and locked up in their Iron Tower. And we see what happens when the soldiers and the scholars of a world are disconnected from the rest of society. And so, in a lot of ways, whatever happens in Throne, frankly, in both the series and in the real world, I want to see a greater connection between the people that do what I do for a living and the people and the rulers that those people put in place. And hopefully those rulers that those people put in place, like Max said, are voted for and decided on as a larger body than just by blood.
Right on. Well said.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I wanted to run through a couple of other details from the book, and then we'll talk a little bit about one of your chapters, Matt. It looks like you guys said about 20 different authors? Is that right, what I heard before?
No, we got 30.
30,
man. We got
wow,
30.
Yes. I didn't...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so there's definitely, you know, this book may not be everyone's cup of tea, but there is something in that book for everyone. And I can pretty much guarantee you that anyone that picks it up is going to find several chapters that they really, really enjoy because it'll give them a new perspective.
I agree. So, and yeah. In fact, I grabbed a few chapter names just to tease those concepts and to back up what you're saying here, because I definitely agree. Just as an aside, too, it was funny to me. I saw that there were so many authors, and I started counting, and I was like, nah, I'm not going to count. I'll just ask them. It was such a big list.
Yeah.
Okay, so the book is divided into four war-centric sections. You've got people in war, technology in war, combat in war, strategy in war. And a few of the chapter titles that stood out to me, The Mother of Dragons, Defiant Leadership for Uncertain Times, Insights from Machiavelli for Those Who Seek the Iron Throne, Weapons of Mass Destruction in Westeros and Beyond, and The Wildlings at the Wall, When Climate Drives Conflict. That last one's a big one, and it's been in my mind recently and off and on since the beginning of the series, because I think a lot of people noticed the climate change allegories in Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, but it's come up even more recently because a lot of people are starting to learn around the world that while climate change is politicized, it's not nearly as politicized in the military. The military takes it very seriously, as far as my understanding goes. Matt, you would know better than me on that. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I obviously, because of the uniform I wear, have to be somewhat guarded in what I say. That being said, there are aspects. Max, you know, it's really funny because Max just can rail on certain subjects that I have to be relatively more careful with. That being said, the shift in the climate is a fact. I live in Colorado, where we look to California's fires and we see our future. There are, and so, you know, hunting seasons are changing, snow and rain accumulation are changing, the Arctic sea ice is melting, and it's changing the environment in the far, far north. While it's sometimes difficult to pin down specifics and how they interrelate about the shift in climate, one thing that we can learn more generally from the climate and the threat from the north in the White Walkers in Westeros is that there are things happening all the time, great distant events very far from us, that are, you know, that are going to rock and change our world. You know, so imagine sort of an unsuspecting shopkeeper in King's Landing from the north, the White Walkers and the and, you know, at one point that person was worried about the free folk from beyond the wall. There was a threat. That threat is clearly growing. You know, and it's metastasized and it's gotten worse. And that person has no inkling or idea that a major change to her world is on its way. And to some extent, you do see those parallels with the shift in the climate. We know things are changing. We don't know exactly how they'll change. We just know that they certainly won't change for the better. So, you know, that's generally.
Right on. Well, Max, what do you think about
and
this?
By, Well, I mean, as far as climate change, but there is historical precedent for this. We know from the writings of Roman historians that Julius Caesar's great uncle, Gaius Marius, saved Rome from wailing tribes of German barbarians who had come from the north because of climate change. We know that they had had years of inundations. They'd had too much rain, too many floods, and their land was unsustainable. And then they packed up and moved. And they crashed into the Roman army because they liked the Italian sun. And we see this all the time. No, you can't blame them for that. And you can't blame the climate refugees, which is a real thing now. There are, I mean, as a civilian, as an outsider, I can tell you that I go to a lot of strategic conferences, and there's always a talk about what's going to happen with climate refugees. Because they're real and they exist. They are going to come to other societies. They're going to put pressure on those societies. They're going to create political movements. I mean, let's be very clear that the alt-right movement's greatest ally are the waves of refugees that are coming to Europe because of the Syrian civil war. Climate creates conflict, which creates refugees, which destabilize other societies. And we have to prepare for that. This is very real. There's a reason that Vladimir Putin put a Russian flag on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Because for the first time in hundreds and hundreds of years, the Arctic is in play. And the Russians are investing in nuclear icebreakers. We know the Chinese are looking at them very carefully. For the first time, the Canadians have to invest in a submarine fleet. This is very, very real, and there's dollars and cents, and there's blood at stake, and it's not about politics anymore. This is a reality from a national security point of view.
Aziz, if I can interject, just because this is what I think the great strength of fiction and film is, and you hit that nail on the head with Admiral Stavridis's foreword, the line from it, you know, what if questions are the root of strategic thinking. This is Max's great work from World War Z. You know, if something terrible happens, insert whatever that terrible thing might be, how will this shake up the globe? Who's a winner and who's a loser? You know, there's a certain reality in World War Z's context that, you know, island states do differently and do better than other polities and governments. Similarly, in Westeros, obviously, it's kind of you've lost the shake of the dice if you live in the far north.
Yes.
Versus the Iron Islands, say. But this sort of thinking just doesn't come out of nowhere. You have to practice it. And it doesn't matter if you're in a uniform or not, you can get practice at it by consuming film and fiction. I do, and I learned an awful lot in the doing.
That's great. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And if I have one way I like to think about the bottom lines of climate refugees and all that is that just as simply as I can put it, is climate change is going to reduce the amount of land that exists, or at least livable land. And that just says so much right there. And if we take it back to Game of Thrones, that's what's happening to the wildlings. It's not just the White Walkers as a army that's pushing them. It's getting so cold that they can't stand it anymore. And if we see... we're not exactly sure how much this will play out in the show, but in the books it seems a little more like there'll be a little more detail to it all, and we'll see a lot more of that struggle. We'll see large amounts of population starving and freezing, and then the spread of disease that comes when people are starving and packed in close quarters together. And it's very much what you guys are talking about, with diminishing resources, diminishing land, and it's a great allegory here. To go back to our conversation about Ned and his heroism. Well, Matt, that is one of your chapters, and it's the chapter I focused most on for this interview. It's called Ned Stark, Hero of the Seven Kingdoms, and Why the Good Guys Win in the End. You also wrote Epilogue, Down from the Citadel, Off the Wall, and You Know Something, Jon Snow, about the qualities of a strategic leader with P.W. Singer. But I want to focus on the Ned Stark stuff, especially because Max touched on it a bit as well. So I want to say that this is a great topic for this fandom because people love discussing Ned's morality. He's often held up as a true hero of the series, even though he's not in it very long. And that speaks to your point. He's not in it very long, but his legacy has lasted, and that is a central issue here. So please tell us what inspired you about Ned and about his heroism and all this related stuff.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because I think it's one of the aspects of this story that's most useful in real life. And, you know, Max is, you know, what's weird is that we're in total agreement on, his comments earlier about what got Micah killed. Ned never was and never will be perfect. But I do think that the way that he conducted his life, has had a long shadow on the show and has influenced characters well beyond his lifespan. I was going to say natural lifespan, but obviously it was natural lifespan. So for a lot of people, you know, he is essentially a fool, more heroic in his convictions than strategic at his core. You know, and so, you know, he was, maybe, you know, some people just like what Cersei said, he's just a soldier following orders. So he's just sort of mindlessly following orders right up to the gallows and his own beheading. But I see him as something different. And I think that there are qualities in him about sort of heroes and good guys that actually translate off of the page and off of the screen. And it helped me to better think through whether or not the good guys actually win. Like, how should we think about heroes in conflicts and at war? And if you peel that onion back pretty far, go to Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was, when he was trying to understand species, he looked at heroes, so to speak, that would protect others that were not from their own line. And he realized that if they were to sacrifice themselves for others, then that behavior would be punished and their line would die out. And, you know, to some extent, you kind of with Ned Stark, if you just look at him in an individual single lifespan context, you know, he did the right thing, quote unquote, over the course of his life. And, you know, that often got him in trouble or in the end, perhaps got him executed. But when you take a wider view and you look at humanity writ large, we are successful because we cooperate with other people in large groups. That's the only way that you get the Great Wall of China, or, you know, you get Hadrian's Wall, or you get, New York City to some extent, you know, all these aspects of our culture and our civilization. And so you can actually see through Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson's work, that humans are mostly successful because we're so social. And there's some of us that lead within that context that are servant leaders of values and ideals. And, they choose again and again to serve others and ideas over themselves. And I think you get that with Ned Stark. He inspires others to carry on. He rallies allies to his side over time. He unifies others with his goodwill and his principled leadership. You know, he has a moral code. And he didn't win in his lifetime in the classic sense. But others, his sons, and I kind of put that in quotes, you know, for John, but kept on. And those ideals, I think, did live on in Jon Snow and the good guys in a lot of ways. We see it on screen. The good guys usually do win in the end. It just takes a little bit longer, and it can get bloody. But I think I see that in the real world too. You know, look at the strategic board. North Korea does not have allies knocking on the door, Pyongyang's door, to join up. You know, the United States is not and never will be perfect, but we do have some guiding values that have attracted allies over time. So I think that it functions not just on the human level, but on the societal level. And, you know, Max and I were on a panel recently talking about this, and, you know, he pointed out the difference between, two major figures in the 1960s, Second Lieutenant William Calley, who was the military officer in Vietnam that committed the My Lai massacre. You know, people don't remember him, or if they do, they've tried to forget his life and his example. But he committed that horrible atrocity within just a few years of most of the most inspiring words that you could ever hear from Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King lived far shorter than William Calley did, but Martin Luther King's inspiring life and ideas and value set have lived on, not just in a federal holiday, but with people in a very real, concrete way. So I think that we see the same thing in the real world that we get out of Ned Stark. He was never perfect, but I do think that he is emblematic of the way that heroes and the, quote, good guys function in the
really,
real
world. Yeah, that's a really great way to say it. And also, if you look at their legacy, like you said, Ned's not in the story very long, but people are still fighting for his ideals. In the books, you have characters openly stating that their loyalty is to this to Ned's girl or what have you. And it's also a little bit ironic, a little bit meta, in a sense that you have in a story that features quite a few, quite a lot of the living dead. You have dead people's concepts living on. Their life lives on after them, even though they're not living. So that's just kind of a interesting little aspect of the series to look at. Well, Max, what do you think about, you've had some thoughts on Ned. Do you have any thoughts on anything that, matches said or any counterpoints or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, most definitely, because I think that Ned is a good man in a bad system. And Ned believes in the rule of law. The problem is, in that system, the king is the law. And that's the problem. And that is exactly why when Matt took the oath of service, it was not to the President of the United States. It was to the Constitution. That is exactly why the founders of this country did those little things that just seem like semantics on a piece of paper, but were critical for the time they grew up in. And the time they grew up in, the king was the law. And those who had the weapons, the armed forces, their blood oath was to one human being. And so, as a result, now our armed forces, their blood oath is to a piece of paper, and on that piece of paper is a set of ideals that live on forever.
Yes.
And that is why, literally, if Matt were given an illegal order, if Matt were given an order on the battlefield that is not constitutionally valid, Matt has a legal, not just a moral, but a legal duty to disobey, because Matt's service is to the Constitution. And that is critical in the system that we have, as opposed to the system in Game of Thrones. So, and that says something, that speaks volumes to why that system is bad in Game of Thrones. And that also speaks volumes to why we're having such a rough time spreading democracy throughout the world. Ned Stark never grew up with democracy. There was never a democratic time. Ned grew up during kings. He served kings. Kings were all he knew. And that is the problem. This is why we were scratching our heads in Iraq, saying, why aren't people just loving democracy? Well, they never knew it.
Yeah.
democracy takes generations. It takes grandparents talking to their grandchildren. It takes creating a reality that could be 100 years old for people to say, no, that's not right to have one person running things. I know in my bones, because I grew up in a time when everybody had a voice. And if you're going to spread democracy to a dictatorship, you better be prepared to be there for 100 years. It's the reason that the generation that grows up in Germany now has no memory of Hitler. Mm. And their parents have no memory of Hitler. But if we had left, let's say, 5 years after World War II, if we had said, all right, we did it, mission accomplished, and gone home, everybody in Germany would have grown up during either Hitler or the Kaiser or a corrupt 20-year republic. And they would have said, okay, let's go back to the way we know. And so Ned Stark, had he grown up in a democratic system, he wouldn't have just sighed and said, king take what he wants.
Yeah, he wouldn't just accept this reality as a reality. He would, right. He would realize there's an alternative. And in his world, the only alternatives are these other forms of government in Essos, which aren't really that much better. Maybe they're slightly better in some ways, but they're not appealing to Ned Stark.
No, and you use the perfect word, reality. In Ned Stark's mind, reality is good king or bad king. It never even occurs to Ned Stark, no king, because he's never seen that work. Yeah. Ned Stark never saw a functioning republic, and had he might, he would have said, hey, wait, whoa, 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 there's another way.
It's like the, and if he looks back in his own history, all he'll find is that, oh, before there were just more kings. The only difference is that everyone was more fractured. Instead of one king, there were seven, and before that, there were hundreds. And it just the farther back in time you go, you still have kings, and before that, you just have characters with similar titles that effectively mean king, like lord or chieftain.
Yes, exactly, and that's why, like, when I look at Daenerys' dragons, all I see is a flying Gestapo. Because when you study dictatorships, it's rule number one for the dictator to always have two armies. Mm. And that prevents a coup, because you don't want the unsullied suddenly turning their spears on you. You need someone to guard the guards. And that's why every dictator has always had a Waffen-SS or a KGB or the SAVAK, which was the Shah of Iran's secret police. And so those dragons are the only thing that guarantee Daenerys' power base, which is exactly what dictators do.
Okay, that's interesting. Matt, do you have any rebuttals to any of that, or anything else to add?
No, I mean, I love it. You know, when Max mentioned that the other day, it blew my mind, because it was a dimension that I genuinely had never considered. I was looking at the dragons. So there's actually a bit of a debate. Some people refer to the dragons as nuclear weapons to some extent. Most of us in the strategic and military community see them as air power. They're either for strategic bombing, as at Harrenhal, burning the fortification down, or they're air-to-air, which was the dance with dragons.
Yeah.
Which is dogfighting for dragons, so to speak. And then, their close air support. And we've seen that a few times in the series. And, I'm actually just like everybody else at the edge of my seat to see what happens when we see the blue-eyed and the blue-eyed, dragon take on, I don't even know if you can call them brothers anymore.
Yeah.
Dead. I'm not sure what to call them anymore, but, this is one of the things that you get out of a book with a lot of diversity. You don't just get, diversity of chapters, you get diversity of ideas. And, Max has got a lot of those, and I love listening to him. So
right on. Yeah, that is really coming out in this podcast here as well. We're seeing a lot of different takes, things that agree but are from a different perspective, and some disagreement as well, but mostly just great conversation. And something that really is one other thing I want to point out, that's a common sort of touchstone, that launching point, so to speak, for discussions, is something that you guys touched on both in these conversations just now, which is the matter of perspective. And, we put ourselves in Ned Stark's shoes, and someone who would say, well, why doesn't Ned want democracy. Well, going through that exercise of putting ourselves in his shoes and thinking about his life and everything he's experienced, it doesn't make any sense for him to consider democracy. He's not a kind of creative guy that would conceive of it on his own. That would be the only way that would ever come into his mind, unless somebody else somehow came along and said, Ned, check out this idea. What if everyone had a vote? You know, and he might come around on that if this were some sort of what-if scenario. But initially, it would some of these same sort of things you talked about, Max, is where it takes a long time for these systems to get accepted. And even if Ned were to accept it, it would take a lot for it to really last.
Oh, of course. Because once you have a republic, you then need to prove that it works. And that's what it really comes down to. I mean, there was a wonderful story. I think it was like the day after we pulled down Saddam Hussein's statue. There was a young army officer saying that he was inundated by the citizens of the town asking who was going to take away their garbage. Because suddenly the garbage collectors weren't showing up. And that's the thing is a republic only works if you make it work. So it's not just an idea. You have to get the lead out of the water in Flint, Michigan. You have to get jobs. You have to get health care. You have to do all these things. And when a republic doesn't do that, then a strong man comes forward and says, I'll do it. Or at the very least, promises he'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you get kings. That's where kings come from. You know, I'll do it. And so that,
yeah.
I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, just add as an interjection, and this exact, even under different auspices, this has happened. Like Rome was so anti-king, but they still got Sulla and Caesar. You know, they had all these things in place, and it still just happened.
Oh, it's the hardest thing in the world to keep, and it's so hard not to be corrupted by power. The more power you give, the more people want to hold on to. And this is what I write about in my chapter: is let's say John Eris. They marry, and they have a wonderful incest relationship, and they rule the kingdoms. But then what's to happen from them 30 years from now becoming corrupt? Because most dictators don't start out as bloodthirsty tyrants. They start out as young, gorgeous, charismatic freedom fighters. Young Fidel Castro, young Robert Mugabe, young Muammar Gaddafi. All of them started out as people who just wanted good for their people. They were all Jon Snow. And then 30 years later, oh, God, that's what power does to you?
Hmm. What's amazing to me, too, is how often the characters in the story come so close to realizing this. At one point, Catelyn is upset with Rob for writing Jon into his will, for naming Jon his heir, and Catelyn is upset with that because, okay, let's say you can trust Jon, but what about his grandkids? Won't they, maybe they'll come for your grandkids? And at no point does she stop to think of, oh, it's the system that's messed up. I mean, you know, it's fair for her not to think of that. Why would she? It's like, just like Ned, it's never been a thing in her worldview. But the elements are there. George gives us that. He shows us that, you know, all the different ways that this impacts people, and they don't even realize how they're suffering.
No, and even if you do have a great emperor to the day they die, like you said, you don't know what's coming next. You know,
yeah.
The Romans prospered under Caesar Augustus. He was an amazing emperor till the day he died, but he set in place a system that was eventually going to give you Nero, who burned Rome to the ground.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, all his great efforts, and you're right, the system just fell apart because of these almost you want to call them, not loopholes, but these unaddressed systematic problems. And
when
as
you set
said,
the wheel in motion, you know,
yeah.
Once you set that wheel in motion, you can't tell who it's going to run over.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, that power is so enticing and corrupting once they have it, and people will do anything to keep it. And that's the problem with giving them too much power in the first place. And, of course, a king, who has more power than a king? Not many people.
No.
Okay, well, let's tackle a couple other simple, quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Because there's so many authors and so many topics, we've touched on how many things that I'm sure there were some of the topics and issues raised to some of the other authors that you hadn't considered. Are there any that you'd like to illuminate right now, something from some of the other chapters that stood out to you, something that you think would be interesting to the listeners, maybe to encourage more interest in the book in general?
Yeah, you know, for me, it's just as important the lessons on valuing and holding on to the democracy we have. I think watching this show really gives you a sense for really how terrible, truly terrible war is. It demands death, real people, innocent people, good people die. You know, and it's in the worst, most tragic ways. And we see it in the show, like Micah. We were just talking about that. But when I was in Iraq in 2003, a tank driver in my unit was drowned when the tank he was in was rolling through the desert. It popped up the lip, up kind of a sand dune, and then went nose down in a wadi, which is like a big puddle, and like a big, you know, small body of water in the middle of the desert, and it got stuck, and he drowned inside the hatch. You know, I mean, that's every bit as randomly cruel as what you get sometimes out of the show. And if a character in the show that you really like and you really start to care for dies, you get a fraction of a sense of what it's really like to be part of war. And I've mentioned this to Max before. I wanted to, but I didn't get the chance to dedicate the book to Hodor. Because I don't know if this is clear. You know, fans are going to have a more precise understanding of this than me, deeper fans, that is. But I think he had a glimpse of and knew what would come at the end of his life and what it would cost him. Now, I can imagine that that's what I interpreted out of that scene in the on screen. I don't know for sure. But he still, let's just assume that that's true for a moment. He still held the door closed and held evil back to protect other people. And for me right now, I look out at the world and there's 250,000 Americans serving overseas. Guarding places like the DMZ in Korea, our wall, where I was a couple years ago, and all of them have that instinct for service, and many of them are willing to sacrifice for others, like Hodor was.
Yeah.
It's characters like that and people like that are why we should really sort of pay attention just a little bit harder to the conflicts that our country is a part of in the world. And I think that feeling, that sense, is hidden in plain sight on screen in the show. So that's the thing that I really like, matters the most to me when I watch this show.
Okay, yeah, great take. And what about you, Max? What do you think?
Well, I would personally, I would dedicate the show to my favorite character, which is the guy that gets hit by the flying bell when the tower blows up.
Poor guy. Talk about random, right?
Yeah, well, and random. I mean, as going back to my initial meeting with George R. R. Martin, when he talks about his characters make bad choices, and those bad choices help drive the story. But what about the people who don't get a choice? And that happens in war, and that happens in dictatorship, where you become an extra in someone else's story. I mean, basically, we talk about, oh, Game of Thrones, there's so many characters. Well, not in a cast of millions.
Yeah.
if this were in this giant show that is a war, there's only about 24 speaking parts, and everybody else is an extra.
It's so true.
And that's what happens. So that's who I would dedicate it to. And I also think that one of the important metaphors we haven't touched on is the Night's Watch and the volunteer service.
Okay, yeah.
And I think this is a really important theme. Because as a civilian, you know, we're living in this post 9/11 world with this bullshit phrase, thank you for your service. Right? And let's be honest. For a lot of us who don't want to admit it, this country does not want to admit it. But thank you for your service is code for better you than me.
Mm.
And because we have a volunteer service, they're not our sons anymore. They're not our fathers, our mothers, our brothers, our friends, our neighbors. They're not us anymore. They're superheroes on the screen that we watch and worship from afar, but really don't care about.
Hmm.
And there's a reason we're involved in 7 major wars right now, because it's not we anymore. It's they. And so in the show, when they send people to the Night's Watch, it's really because they don't have anything else to do with their lives.
Mm.
It's sort of the metaphor for, like, the losers. You sort of send the people with no other options to join the Night's Watch. And I'm sorry, but that is, I think, is a horrible blight, a shame on our society, because That's part of the narrative, that you only join the army if you're some crazed redneck who likes to blow stuff up, or if you have no other options. And I literally saw that on Modern Family.
And it's so not true. I mean, just, it's, you're right, that's a perception, but it's not, so, you're right, that you're 100% right that that is a common perception, but yeah, it's
did
it's
you
bad.
See that episode of Modern Family when Luke, the loser kid, can't get into college, and his mother's like, well, you can always join the army.
I didn't, but that's, I'm sure I've seen that sentiment elsewhere on another sitcom, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the sentiment, and it is 100% wrong. I'm sure there are kids who join the military because they don't have anything else to do, but then I meet guys like Matt who had the world at his fingertips.
Yes.
And he gave it up to serve, and I meet these people all the time. And so I think the metaphor for the Night's Watch is a really painful but necessary mirror we need to hold up to ourselves and ask ourselves as civilians, how do we really see those who protect us?
That's a great question. You guys have covered Star Wars, like you said, in a similar manner, and now this is maybe, would you say this is a bit of a bigger project for Game of Thrones or something along those lines?
Well, it felt like after the first project, you know, when you write, it's often a fairly solitary activity. I write quite a bit, Max writes quite a bit. This was the most collaborative project I've ever done by a long stretch. It was like getting the most, when you're younger and you're a student and you're in a group project with three or four people, that seems difficult. I mean, this was like that on steroids. It felt like climbing a mountain, to do Strategy Strikes Back. How Star Wars explains modern military conflict. To do it a second time was kind of like standing at the bottom of the mountain, having already climbed it and already gotten back down and looking back up at the top and saying, yeah, now it's time to climb it. So this was truly a fun project, but it was not always my favorite thing to do. So I'm grateful for the ideas to be out in the world. I'll put it that way. That's
right on. Yeah. I have worked on book projects with multiple people before as well, not 30 people, which is part of why I was so amazed, because I know what it's like to work with 8 other people, and it's hectic, so I can hardly imagine. That's 4 times more people, which is just, that blows my mind.
Matt's audience was primarily military, and I think from a military point of view, the challenge is trying to convince the established warrior class that fiction is valuable to their trade. From a civilian point of view, my challenge is trying to convince my fellow civilians why they need to learn about strategy. Because this is a very common thread. We were literally told after 9/11 that the only obligation we had as voters and taxpayers, as Americans, was to pray, hug our kids, and go shopping. And that was it. And that's why we find ourselves in this problem. We have been divorcing ourselves from our own national interests, really for half a century, and then it really hit the watershed moment after 9/11. But this sheepdog model is not working, especially now. We are up against countries like Russia and China that are marshaling the resources of their entire nation to roll back democracy. And we just saw this in our election.
Yep.
Russia was able to damage our democracy in ways that the Nazis and the Japanese in World War II could have only dreamed. And they did it without firing a shot. And this goes to the core of being in a democracy. Because in those dictatorships, you get to blame the government. We don't. You don't get to say the government because we are the government. And so we have an obligation, a duty, and we're not supposed to say that in America. We're supposed to live for ourselves every minute of every day. But we do have a duty to understand the big picture. We have to understand the world we live in and the issues that trickle down into our little lives. And if we don't do that, we're not going to make good choices at the ballot box. And then we're going to elect leaders that take us down the wrong path. So as taxpayers and as voters, i.e. as citizens, We need to learn about strategy. And by the way, maybe if we actually learned about war, maybe we'd have a few less wars.
Yeah, I mean, learning about the strategy of war does also reveal its difficulties and all the challenges, and it allows people to stop with the simple, oh, we're the biggest military in the world, we shouldn't have any trouble. That kind of sentiment, right. Like that, where we're just rolled, where they expect us to roll over countries, even though that's almost never how it works. And look at our history.
Right.
It's always been complicated.
And maybe if we learned more about wars, when it came time to push that button as voters, we would learn to understand the difference between wars of necessity and wars of convenience.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we'd be able to push back on our leadership when they tell us, hey, we got to do this. And we'd say, no, not this one. That war was necessary. This war is bullshit.
Well, it may sound trite to say, but education is a key that comes from all that, and one of the best ways to educate oneself is to read more. And, well, good way to wrap this up is by re-recommending the book we've been talking about for the last hour or so, Winning Westeros, How Game of Thrones Explains Modern Military Conflict. Again, you can pre-order it now, and I hope we've inspired you to check it out. There's so many great discussions to be had from within the book, from within other people talking with you about it, and with some of the things we've already discussed. There's just a lot to dig into, and I'm enjoying it myself. Like I said, I haven't finished it, but I'm looking forward to reading the rest, and maybe I'll send you guys some messages with some of my thoughts about some of this other cool stuff that I read. It'll probably inspire me on some podcast topics as well. So everyone's winning. Well, thanks very much for coming, guys.
Aziz, thank you so much. History of Westeros is clearly for huge fans of Game of Thrones, but I think both Max and I are now huge fans of History of Westeros, so we'll be listening definitely through the rest of the season. Thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you very much for saying so. Thanks, you too, Max.
Thanks, man. This is great.
All right. Well, everybody, check us out next time, and be sure to check out Winning Westeros. Thanks to my guests for coming today. And I normally sign off by saying Valar Reredus, but in this case, we'll just say Valar Redus because no one has read this book yet. And we'll see you all. We'll see you all next time. Thanks again.